Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. If you've had any experience caring for a family member or a loved one who's losing their memory, you don't need me to tell you just how painful it can be for everybody involved. That experience is going to become more and more familiar as the number of people living with Alzheimer's disease in this country continues to rise. But the thinking about how to care for such patients is also starting to evolve. Staff writer Larissa McFarker recently spent some time at a new kind of assisted living facility for memory care patients, one of only a few like it in the United States. The place is called The Lantern, located in the Cleveland suburb of Chagrin Falls, Ohio. It houses around 40 residents who have some form of dementia or Alzheimer's.
Okay, let's go for a walk.
Let's take a little walk.
Should we hold hands?
Yeah.
Okay.
Erna and I were walking down a wide hallway, and it had been designed to look like a street in a small American town of maybe 75 years ago. The floor was covered in carpeting, kind of green mottled with a darker green that made it look a little bit like grass. And there was daylight coming in from skylights, and then between the skylights there were light panels that were painted to look like sky. The illusion was surprisingly effective. It didn't fool you exactly. You didn't feel as though you were actually outdoors, but it alleviated the claustrophobia that you usually feel in a hospital corridor. It felt like somewhere nice to walk.
Would you like to meet my mom? My mom is a nice person.
I would love to.
She's very easy with everybody.
There were other residents walking too, some of them with aides and some of them just by themselves going for a stroll. In the middle of the unit, there was an open space that was, again, designed to look like a kind of small park or a town square. There was a fountain, a few benches, and there were a few people gathered around some tables, sitting on chairs, playing a game with some aides.
What does that say, Carmen?
It says horses.
Now you have to look on the table and find a horse.
Yeah, I can't bring a horse. It's in my house. I can't bring a horse in my house.
Carmen, look.
Too big.
What's this?
It looks like one.
Yep.
I don't want a horse. I couldn't have a horse in my house.
Larissa, I used to go visit my grandmother at what I guess you call a unit, and there were people screaming. There were TVs blasting, which may or may not have been upsetting to the patients. It was hard to gather. People were so far gone in some ways. But it certainly was upsetting to me. How different is this, and how was it conceived? What's the idea here?
The idea is that people who live there should not feel like they live in a hospital. The idea is that they live in something that feels as much as possible like an ordinary town. Mm. And you know, people find themselves saying things like, oh, where's your house? It's at the other end of the street. So each room for the resident had a front porch and people could decorate them however they wanted to. The staff are extremely open to accommodating personal touches on the part of the residents to make them feel at home. There's one house outside which there's a large dentist's office sign.
It's a big sign. It was his dental sign that was on his building.
Molly Gebler's dad used to be a dentist, and everyone at the Lantern still calls him Dr. Joe.
And I had called the Lantern and said, hey, there's this dental sign. Is there any way we can put it next to his house? And there wasn't even, they didn't look at the sign. They didn't see the sign. It was a yes, absolutely, because they support that. They want it to be their home. Mm-hmm. That's what their philosophy is all about, is just continuing to live their true life.
Well, it's not their true life. And in a sense, and I hate to use this word, but we're fooling them.
Well, yes. You know, Molly told me that he used to spend a lot of time asking her why he wasn't still practicing. Where was his office?
We really get into it a lot. Used to get into it a lot. We had sold the office, and he was mad about that. And
right.
Every day, that would be the conversation. He'd get angry about it.
What would you say?
You know what? I would, at the beginning, I would say, well, you can't anymore.
Because?
You know, you're not doing well. You're not fit to do it. Yes, I am, and I'm working. Mm-hmm. I get up every morning and I exercise and look at my hands. You know, these hands are, you know, they're ready and they're not shaking, or I'm fine. And
I mean, Mike's experience with my father and other relatives and even friends who have sunk into a state of dementia, or as it got worse, was that they would fixate on an idea and they could not be swayed from it.
Molly says in the early days of her father's sickness, they fought all the time. And so she went to one of the professionals at the Lantern and asked her advice.
So I went to her in tears, and I remember her saying, you can't argue with them. Like, you're not going to get to a resolve.
Mm-hmm.
You have to readjust and find out what it is that he's trying to say, finding out what the conversation is, and then redirecting it. Or saying, okay, so if you were, what do we need to do? What are the steps we need to do to get you back to dentistry? And then go through those steps with him. And then he'll probably go off to something else.
So this is what people call redirection. You know, you go along with it. You say, yeah, okay, we need to get your building back. What are we going to do? And then hope that the distraction will take over before anything really confrontational starts.
So the idea is to engage the project somehow, but not really do anything about it.
Exactly. And Andrea Parado helps train the aides here in how to do that.
So with my one client that struggles with her money issues every day, she worries about where her money is, and has somebody sold her house, and, you know, where's all her stuff, and why can't she just go to the bank? And for her, she just needs a lot of reassurance and a lot of, you know what, let me look into that. Let me see what I can do. Let me see if I can find those resources for you. Let me see if I can get in touch with a lawyer for you. You know, I may not do that because obviously she has a guardian and the lawyers have already deemed her unable to care for herself.
Is that the status quo now in the care of dementia?
Well, it's often not official, but it in fact seems to happen pretty much everywhere. There was a survey not long ago that found that almost 100% of care staff in dementia wards say that they lie to patients, and something like 70% of doctors say they do too. But it's still a very fierce debate because people don't like the idea of lying to patients. They don't call it lying. They call it therapeutic lying. They call it going with the flow. There's lots of euphemisms.
What's the alternative then? Constantly correcting people?
Well, you know, that did used to be the norm in dementia care, and some places took it even further. There was a protocol called reality orientation, where the idea was that if you constantly drilled people with dementia in facts about everyday life, they might regain a grasp on reality. So things like, you know, the day of the week, the month of the year, who the president is, what the weather is, that kind of stuff. And that kind of drilling doesn't happen much anymore, but a lot of care homes still have strict no-lying policies. And Andrea said she worked in a place like that when she first started in this in dementia care, and she really tried to stick to the honesty rule.
I tried it, Larissa. I can't even lie, and I felt so guilty because I told this 90-year-old woman that I'm sorry, you know, you're 90 and your mom has passed away, and she just started crying. She just started crying, and she had to grieve all over. And from that moment on, after I sat there and cried and held her and comforted her, I stopped right then and there and said, I'm never doing that again. I cannot put somebody through that ever again.
Yeah.
From now on, your mom went shopping. Your mom had to go to the store. I don't know, but it's never going to be your mom has died. Never. I can't do that. I know that some people find that it's wrong to lie to somebody. I mean, it's a 90-year-old human being, and she has the right to have the truth told to her. I get that. But when you're in the moment, You'll change your mind.
It seems like a horrifying way to make a living, to be a caregiver and have to cause people to grieve all over again.
Oh, it's miserable. I mean, and we're talking all day, every day. And, you know, it's even more complicated because of their memory loss, someone can be miserable and not even know why.
And one of the things that we are constantly talking about on these subjects is the notion of dignity. So how do dignity and lying come into conflict or coexist?
Yeah, so I asked Andrea about that.
Dignity is being respectful, I guess, of people's needs, of who they are. And with Alzheimer's disease, you have to respect them for where they are in the moment. I got in trouble at a nursing home once because I had a client ask me if I could get her some Walt Disney coloring books. I got in trouble because it was undignified for me to give her little kid coloring books. So my question then would be, if I am at a stage 5 of the disease, okay, and my cognitive functional ability is at the age of a 4 to 10 to 12 year old, why would it be considered undignified to give me a coloring book that is absolutely significant within my cognitive functional age? Dignity is about respecting a person for the person that they are and who they are and what their needs are. And does that make sense?
Absolutely. So it does make sense what she's saying. She's really redefining dignity.
Right. She's defining it in terms of meeting people where they are in a moment in time and their capabilities.
Exactly.
Does that seem right to you?
You know, honestly, when I, in the process of working on this story, people talked about dignity all the time. And I started to kind of hate that word because it felt like it was drawing attention to what was not dignified about their situation. You know, maybe we should just be using a different word.
Like what?
Well, if you keep talking about dignity and that's preventing you from giving someone a coloring book, maybe something else should be the goal. Like, I don't know, happiness or autonomy or living your life as you want to insofar as that's possible. But even leaving the word dignity aside, you know, it can sound when you talk to people who work in these units that lying is the answer, that it solves these problems. But in fact, lying itself brings problems of its own. So, okay, remember Molly Gebler, for instance. She stopped fighting with her father about whether he could practice dentistry again, and things got easier. But things are unpredictable with memory, and somebody may remember nothing in the morning, and then in the afternoon, suddenly they're sharp again, and this brings up its own problems.
So one time he called me. He was upset about something, and I said, well, okay, I will come by. And I didn't, because usually it's because he wasn't in his right seat for breakfast, or, you know, I mean, and I can't be running here every second.
Right.
So the next day he called again, and he said, you know, are you going to come over? And I said, yes, I will. He said, oh, like what you told me yesterday?
Oh, God.
Well, it's one thing to learn to lie to someone you care about, but to get caught doing it.
Well, this is exactly the problem, because when you're taking care of someone with dementia, it can seem like the only thing that matters is their happiness and getting through the next moment if you're right in the middle of it. But, you know, I talked to this philosopher, Cicela Bock, who wrote a book about lying, and she drew my attention to exactly what you pointed to, which is the person with dementia is not the only person that matters. There's also you, the one who's doing the lying. What effect does that have on you? You get into the habit of lying every day, every day, every day to the person with dementia, and you tell yourself, well, that's for them. That's to make them happy. But as we all know, you can make all kinds of people happy by lying. So where do you draw the line? Sooner or later, you might find yourself lying a lot.
You think this is going to bleed into the rest of your life and your dealings with people who don't have dementia somehow?
Once you tell yourself lying is okay if it makes someone happy, you're opening a very wide door. And furthermore, there's the effect on other people who are around you. So suppose you're at a doctor's office with your parent with dementia. Everyone in the doctor's office, including, let's say, your small child sitting next to you, sees you lying your head off to your parent, obviously. Well, that contributes to a general sense that lying is okay, lying is kind, and that can have the potential to do something very, very dangerous, which is undermine our general sense that people usually tell the truth. A kind of social trust that is really precious and really fragile. And, you know, another time I saw this play out in the Lantern, we were sitting around a table with a few residents, and one woman named Mary was not paying attention because she was worrying about her husband.
Well, my husband is in the hospital since this morning, and I want to see him, and nobody to take me.
Mary's husband died years ago, but she didn't remember.
What if we go pray for him? What if we go pray for him? Would that help?
But I got to see him.
Well, we can do that after we say a little prayer, okay?
Just take me home, okay?
And when no one would take her to see him in the hospital, she started asking to go home.
You need him. Your house is right here.
I only live about two blocks from here.
Tell her, what does the house look like?
Huh?
What does the house look like?
Well, it looks like a cute house. Yeah, it's a nice house.
Do you have a garden there?
I have a garden, yeah.
Do you grow vegetables or flowers?
Both, but I have to take care of it. But now there's nobody there. So please, somebody take me home. It's only two blocks away from here.
And she asked one person after another. She asked all the aides around the table. One person said she was out of gas. Somebody else said their car was in the shop.
Okay. We're going to have to wait a little bit, okay, until I get my car fixed, and I'll take you.
You'll take me then?
Yeah, once my car gets fixed by the fixer, we're going to go.
Okay.
But you have to be calm.
Nobody can take me, huh?
No, everyone's car is messed up.
Huh?
Mary asked me too.
Can you do it for me?
I don't have a car here.
They got here on the bus.
Huh?
The bus and the cab. They got here on a cab and a bus, so no one have a car. We all here, and we don't have a car.
Gee.
It went around and around and around. This went on for like 15 minutes. And she, I'm not sure she thought, had the thought, people here are lying to me, but she knew something was off.
She was disoriented by what they were telling her.
She knows it can't be true that everyone's car is broken. And she just felt like somehow people are gaslighting me.
Which you were.
Which we were. And did that make her feel better? No. Now she's surrounded by people who are not only strangers to her, but she doesn't think that they're telling her the truth. I mean, was it the better choice other than telling her her husband was long dead?
So what do you do? You break the rule of lying to her in a useful way?
You know, there isn't one strategy that works all the time.
So 30, 40 years from now, and that's being extremely generous, could be a lot sooner, Larissa. You could be in this situation. I could be in this situation. Your daughters will be in middle age, my sons and my daughter. And after all this time spent with people with dementia, how do you want to be treated?
I don't know. I just do not know. Because the whole thing is that if I had dementia, I wouldn't be the person I am now. You know, if I tried to make a decision for my future self now, you know, I'd be all worried about my dignity and people lying to me and how humiliating that might be. But future me might just want to sit at a table and just get on with coloring something in a coloring book and be lied to. So I don't know.
That's Larissa McFarker, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and you can find a terrific piece that she wrote about this subject at newyorker.com.
I'm David Remnick, and that's The New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.